Hey, welcome back to I Am Nature, the show where we look for solutions to enviro problems. And this week I have a knock 'em out of the park guest, Andrew Johnson. Andrew, are you there?
I'm here, Brian. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, well, my pleasure. And I always say hello to my great producer, Angela Black.
Hi, Brian.
So I see you've got an incredible guest again coming up tomorrow night.
Yeah, Jim Mars. That's going to be awesome. And Brent Holland is joining me for the 2 hours since they're friends, and that'll go really well. So, yes, tomorrow night at 10 p.m. Eastern / 7 p.m. Pacific on this Studio B.
All right.
And nice to meet you, Andrew. I'm really looking forward to the conversation over the next couple of hours between you two. I might pipe in from time to time.
Okay, thanks, Angela. Great.
Yeah, no, Angela, yeah, feel free to ask questions because we both, done some shows on geoengineering, and Andrew has a lot to say about that. So I'm looking forward to hearing about it. So Andrew, I usually start with people that aren't well known on my program to discuss their kind of educational background and work background. Mm. Can you give us a little summary of what you've been up to?
Oh, sure, yeah. I grew up in Yorkshire, which is the largest county in England. I went to high school, called a grammar school, and I studied sciences mainly in the later years, and I sort of left high school with maths, physics, chemistry, and general studies. Went on to study computer science and physics at Lancaster University, which is in the northwest of England, because I developed a very, very strong interest in home computing in the sort of early 80s, and finished at Lancaster in 86, was offered a job working for a company called GEC Electrical Projects. It was the British General Electric Company, so I went to work in a place called Rugby, which is where the game of rugby was actually first played.
I didn't know there was a town called Rugby.
Yeah, there's a town called Rugby, which I lived there for about 18 months before I moved away from that company and worked then for a telecommunications company, where I got involved in developing some software for a digital telephone exchange, which was like a forerunner of the ISDN. It could do ISDN digital signaling. Essentially, it was when in the early days of digital telephony. And then I moved away from there after about 4 years. During that time, actually, it was quite interesting because I was able to get over to America. I spent about 9 weeks working in the States in 1991, and with about three or four different trips that I did then. And I was able to visit New York for a couple of days and things like that. Then I ended up going into teaching for 2 years, and I worked as a college lecturer teaching computing subjects for a couple of years, but that didn't really work out very well for me, sort of things like financially, and the working conditions weren't very good. So I then went back and worked in industry in the field of mobile data, mobile telecommunications, where we were developing some software and systems, or systems integration really, I did some work for Derbyshire Police, we've had a pilot project there and worked on that for about a year and a half or so. And then I came out of that, and just before my daughter was born, because I got offered some work with a friend who was doing work around the country, but I could be based at home. So I was working at home developing software. That's been my main sort of focus in those years, developing software. It's computer programming. It's an engineering discipline. So it's 100% problem-solving oriented. You've got to design solutions. You've got to debug them. You've got to sometimes debug other people's solutions when they don't work and they've left the company and cannot be traced or spoken to. So technical background. I then got further into sort of education, I suppose, but in a kind of more support role rather than direct teaching role. And I currently work for an organisation called the Open University which you can look at open.ac.uk if you want to see what they do. And I work as a kind of distance learning tutor for a computing module, and I also do assessments with students who have disabilities so that they can get a special grant to get access to higher education. So this work I do is essentially part-time. Sometimes I get quite a lot of referrals in a month, and sometimes I don't get any. So it gives me quite a lot of flexibility. I am my own boss. There's nobody really breathing down my neck. So I just have to write reports. I get the reports done, and then when I'm not doing the reports, I can do what I like. You know, I can answer emails, update web pages, watch YouTube videos, you know, whatever I feel needs to be done.
So how long have you been involved in sort of the alternative media and all that kind of stuff? You're
Since about 2003, I think if you heard the Royce Holloman interview that I did last week with Royce, where he kindly invited me. But I got into looking at the Disclosure Project, which was the Stephen Greer's initiative that he'd done in 2001. I didn't find out about it until 2003. At that time we'd just got broadband internet here. And, became very interested in that because I'd always been interested in the UFO issue, having had a sighting myself when I was about 10 years old. And I saw sort of, two stars doing acrobatics around one another. And I knew that stars or planets or satellites or planes didn't do acrobatics around one another. So I knew that I'd seen something unusual at the age of 10, and my friend saw it as well. So I'd always had a lifelong, well, from the age of 10 at least, interest in that sort of stuff, paranormal. But when I found out about this Disclosure Project, I knew, you know, having watched that 2-hour press conference, that this had been covered up, and that the witnesses and what they'd said had not been properly reported. I was able to find a small reference on the BBC website they described, for example, they described John Callahan, the head of the Federal Accident Investigations Board, as a UFO spotter. They didn't describe him as the head of the Federal Accident and Investigations Board, you know. So I knew that this had been covered up, and I felt that I had to then tell people that this had been covered up and they were not being told important things. And so from that point, I began to investigate other quote-unquote conspiracies, which next, I suppose, led me into looking into 9/11, which I spoke quite a lot about on Royce's program last week.
That's when I heard you the first time.
Right.
I thought it was very interesting what you had to say, and I thought it was something a bit different. And then I checked out your site. Now, we should tell the listeners your site is very easy to remember, checktheevidence.com. It's full of great information, lots of videos. I was reading today a PDF file called Reinvestigating Climate Change.
Oh, good.
Which I thought was excellent. And maybe we'll talk a bit about that later.
Great.
But anything else you want to say about your website?
Ed? Yeah, well, I think you've sort of summarized it fairly nicely there. It's all free. There's nothing which, I charge for. My objective really is to give out information to anybody that, really wants to listen and find out and learn. I think this is something that I've been trying to do, and my goal in life is to continue to learn when I can and learn where I was originally mistaken. This is something which really I think is very particular with what happens when you start to write software a lot and you get very much into it, because you tend to find quite a lot that your original analysis isn't quite right and you have to refine it. So you do make mistakes, and it teaches you a kind of humility. If you want to get things working, you have to be prepared to realize that your initial assumptions were wrong. So my goal then is to package up information into a hopefully an understandable format, give that to people at no cost, if I can do that, which I has been my philosophy. You know, I have written a paperback book, and if people want to buy a copy from me, they have to pay for it, because that paperback book cost me to buy, you know, so I get them done at Lulu, which is a print on demand thing. So I do, you know, I don't give the paperbacks away free, or not usually, sometimes I do, to the right people in the right circumstances. But going back to the learning situation, I'm a tutor for the Open University, so my job in that role is to help people understand the subject material. And if, to me, if they don't understand the subject material, and they've asked me a question and they don't understand it, it's not their fault that they don't understand it, it's my fault, because it is my responsibility to explain it to them. So that's what I try to do when looking at alternative knowledge. I try to explain it to people in a way that they will understand. And that's, you know, again, one of my sort of basic philosophies, really.
Well, I mean, you created a unique software package that was designed to observe, well, some people call them chemtrails, atmospheric spraying. And maybe you should talk a bit about that, because I was very impressed with your rigor.
Well, thank you.
Your attempt to get at very, you know, knowledge that was hard to before this time, it was very hard to ascertain. I mean, it's just not available, but you found a way around the information gap. So why don't you talk a bit to the listener about
that? Well, thank you. Yes, and I'm glad that you sort of latched onto that and kind of you've described again very well what I tried to do. And that was something that was originally born out of frustration, because after 9/11, I won't talk about that because we talked about that, but I got a, I got to looking into what, as you said, is called chemtrails by some people. And now if you take that word to a serious speaker on this, you know, a climatologist or a meteorologist, they'll kind of pass you off as a conspiracy theorist and won't really want to talk to you. But I became interested in that in 2005 when a grid of trails appeared outside my window, and I photographed this. You'll still find that picture sort of knocking about, basically, because I sent it to Coast to Coast, you know, the talk show, and they put it on their website back in June 2005, so we're almost at the 10th anniversary of that. And then following that, it was quite a long time, and I thought, well, hang on, I want to find out what planes made those trails. I should be able to find that out, because in these days of, you know, so-called international terrorism, surely there must be some way to log what flights, you know, are travelling over a certain area of England or America or whatever. So it wasn't for a couple of years until I really started to think about this, and I wrote to the Civil Aviation Authority, which I think is in this country is equivalent to the Federal Aviation Authority in the US, and I said, look, on this particular date, June the 10th, 2005, at this time, over Derby, can you tell me what flights were in the air? What flights made this grid of trails, please? I want to know. And they couldn't tell me. They basically couldn't tell me, and they said that I had to go to another group called the National Air Traffic Service, I think, or something, NATS. And I wrote to them, didn't really get any kind of intelligible response. And I kind of just left it at that, really. And then I think it was about probably 2006, I'd become aware that there was this sort of radar tracking system that you could get to track aircraft for an aviation, you know, somebody who had a hobbyist who had an interest in aviation. They could buy the
AirNav radar box, right?
Correct. That's exactly, you've got it. The earlier version of that was called the SBS-1 that I'd seen. But yeah, the AirNav radar box, still get them. Anybody wants to get one, they're on, you know, they've got their own website, just AirNav, AIRNAV, radar box, one or two words. Stick that in your favorite search engine and you'll find out all about it. And basically all that it is a sort of clever type of radio receiver. And what the radio receiver does is it receives the signals, which are called ADS-B, which stands for Automatic Dependent Surveillance Broadcast. I think that's what it stands for. And it's a 1 gigahertz frequency signal broadcast from each plane multiple times per second. I think something like 5 or 10 times per second. And that in that, it's a digital signal, and it's encoded within that is the aircraft's altitude, bearing, the call sign, like a registration number as well, which is like the aircraft's license plate, essentially, and a few other bits and bobs of information. And it's sent out in a packet, which can be received by one of these AirNav radar boxes. Plug that into your laptop or your desktop computer. The electronics and software decode the digital signal, and that information is then presented in a graphical format in what they call a kind of mock air traffic controller's display. So it's like, you know, you're an air traffic controller on your PC, you know, in that cool. You know, you can enjoy watching the movements of aircraft and taking off and landing, you know, and see these pretty sort of traces and so forth.
Do you remember how much this box cost you?
Yeah. It cost me £400, which was about $600. So I was obviously a bit reluctant. We're not hard up. I've got an income and so forth, and we're not what you call wealthy either. But I decided eventually, because I was so curious about this and what results I could get from it, let's get one. You know, I decided I saved up enough money. You know, I don't have any other expensive hobbies. You know, I don't go skiing. I don't go, you know, motorbiking. I don't go along sort of holidays or anything like that. So I got one and plugged it in, set up the software and got these traces going. And what I wanted to do was count the number of aircraft. The basic idea was this. Let's see if we can count the number of aircraft that go over my house in a day. Right? How many go over in a day? And so I bought the AirNav radar box to allow me to do that, because the idea then was to look at the days we had trails, you know, when we saw these chemtrails or jet trails or, you know, whatever you want to call them. And I'd count the number of planes that I saw on days with trails, and then I count the number of planes that I saw on days when we didn't have any trails, or break it down into an hourly, you know, an hourly count, so that you could count the number of planes that went over in an hour when there were trails, and then the number in an hour that when there were no trails. So I tried this with the AirNav radar box, but it wasn't an easy task because the software itself wasn't really designed to count the planes. It was designed to observe the planes and look at the traces and so forth. But you couldn't, there was no way of easily counting them. I had to write some additional software myself, which used the AirNav box to count them. And this software, frankly, didn't really work very well. In other words, it would crash, you know, my computer would go into Hibernate, or, you know, Windows would crash or something, and I'd lose my data, I'd lose my counts, you know, so I'd leave it running, and I didn't get enough counts. So I realized after a few months, and I mean, this laptop I had, I actually used it for another purpose. I had to unplug it and take it out with me when I was doing, I do occasional talks and things, and that was what I used for my talks. So I had to take it off, and, you know, I'd forget to switch it back on again or something. So it was a bit of a pain. And it was really probably several years later, about 3 years later, that I'd got what's called a Raspberry Pi, which sounds quite funny, but it's actually a little, and you can get them in the States as well. It's actually a desktop computer, you could almost call it. And what the clever people at the Raspberry Pi Foundation, that's Eben Upton, Liz Upton, and a few other of his colleagues, such as David Braben, he was involved with Raspberry Pi development. David Braben designed a computer game called Elite. I'm not sure many people will know that, but it's a very sort of landmark computer game with 3D graphics in the early 80s. So Raspberry Pi, it's basically what it is, it's the guts of a modern mobile phone, without a screen, without a keyboard, without the phone, just the CPU, the processing power, and the memory. And that, and then it's got two or four USB ports and a network port on it. and then you put a little memory card onto it like you put in your phone or your digital camera, and that has a version of the Linux operating system on it. So you put that in and away you go. You've got a working computer. You plug in your own manky old keyboard and mouse, you plug it into your HDMI TV, and you've got a fully working desktop computer. You can check email, you can plug in a webcam, plug in a hard drive, you can use it as a little gaming machine, whatever you want to do. You can do that with Raspberry Pi for $50. You know, for the basic Raspberry Pi, I think it's like $35, I think it is. And then you've got your keyboard, mouse and screen to add on to top of that. And all the software is essentially free. It's all open source. Great. So I'd come across this idea that what I could do is, rather than tie up my laptop, I could plug the AirNav radar box into the Raspberry Pi. I thought, can I do that? Let's have a look. So I went and looked for that. Couldn't really find much. But what I did find is something even better. I found that you can get a little one of these, like, you know, these USB memory sticks that everybody has for, you know, taking to the office or taking on a train or to college or whatever. You can get like a little USB stick. But what it is it's essentially the receiver that's in the AirNav radio box. It's actually called an SDR, a software defined radio. And you get a little aerial with it, and you plug it into your Windows computer if you want, and it's a software defined radio. It can receive radio, I think, from something like, oh crikey, 20 kilohertz right up to, I think, 2 gigahertz or something, right across the radio spectrum. And you just need to have the right software to decode whatever radio you want. And that includes digital TV, and it includes digital radio, and it includes ADS-B broadcast from aircraft. And some clever person...
What's this called again? It sounds pretty cool.
If you put into a search engine, USB TV dongle, there's several versions, but it's basically USB TV dongle. You can get them for $10, and it has a little. It comes with a little area, not really good enough for receiving TV, probably not good enough for receiving digital radio. And you plug that in, and there's also, you know, there's a whole website devoted to this thing, and it's really interesting how you can hack radio signals. Basically, you can even use it to decode the GSM radio signal from your mobile phone while you're making a call. It doesn't decode confidential information. What it will show you is it will show you the steps that your mobile phone is making while the call is being set up, because GSM is also USB TV dongle in the chat window. That's correct.
So just to cut it short here, so this antenna that you yep. purchased, this USB TV dongle, you could use it as a nav air.
Exactly.
Radar
so
box,
instead of paying $400, I was paying, or $600, whatever it was, I was paying $10. Yeah. And the thing about it was, this problem with counting the aircraft, that I could solve it because somebody had written a program to do what the AirNav radar box did, but with Raspberry Pi. And that was already done. It's on a website. You know, it's called Open Source Software for anyone that's into this. And wow, that's amazing. And it was written in the C programming language. I did C programming professionally for 5 years. So
in your wheelhouse.
Pardon?
It was
in my wheelhouse. That's an expression I don't know, but that, yeah. I know what you mean. I can understand that. Yes, it was in my wheelhouse.
Yes. Up your
it was
alley.
Up my alley. It was right up my alley. My C programming, like, I love it. I love doing it. I'm a nerd. I'm a C programming nerd, basically. And so I took that open source software and I added in the bits that I needed, which took me about, it took me about 3 or 4 months, and I tweaked it and refined it. And so I was able to add in functionality to count the aircraft. And I also got it. One of the things I wanted to do was I wanted to make the Raspberry Pi draw little diagrams of where the aircraft went. And so I was able to take the information from the dongle that had been decoded. All the really techie hard stuff was already done, the decoding of the digital packets, which is quite complicated. That was already done. And I took that information and I was able to set up a counter, set up a chart drawing thing, And I've done a whole 50-minute video about this as well. It's on my website. Anybody that wants to write to me, I'll give them all the links. And anyway, so I did all of that. I actually took the software away on holiday with me. We went to Tenerife in 2013, and I was sat in, you know, in the sunshine with my little laptop, coding up this aircraft counting stuff and doing these charts and stuff like that. And I got it all to work. I was pretty confident I would. There's so much information on the web. Everything I needed was there. And so away it went. And I was able to set it running. There was quite a lot of chiggery-pokery to do. But in essence, what I did was I got this tracker going. I was able to leave it running 24/7. It downloaded the counts into, you know, files for me. And then I was able to collate these files into a database, into a Microsoft Access database. And the other thing which came along fairly much around the same time, which was a key component, was a Raspberry Pi camera. Now, everyone's mobile phone has got a camera on it, and you can take these high-resolution videos now, pretty good quality, etc., etc. I wanted the Raspberry Pi to take a picture of the sky every 30 seconds, I think it ended up being every minute, so 30 seconds ended up being a bit too frequent. So I got the Raspberry Pi camera, which was like about $30, £20 or something, bolted that on, which is a standard thing for the Raspberry Pi, and then I could make time-lapse movies. So I set the thing up on a windowsill in my house. The radio dongle is tracking the aircraft. The camera is photographing a portion of the sky. Only a portion, unfortunately. Only about 1/8 or 1/16 visible sky. But it was enough for my purposes. So I had the time, and then I got the Raspberry Pi to generate time-lapse movies at the end of every day. So I'd get up in the morning, or I could go and look at this thing after a few days, look at the aircraft counts, look at the time-lapse movies. Have we got trails that day? Have we got trails that hour? What were the aircraft counts? That was the whole object of it. And I was able, because it was fairly cheap, I actually got 6 of these trackers running. Some of them simultaneously. I had a few problems because it didn't kept crashing, and, you know, the memory cards got corrupted and, you know, and things like this, or the power would get switched off at the wrong time and this sort of thing. But I did end up, after about 9 months of running these things, I got enough data that I was happy to publish that and say, well, look, here's the data, this is what it shows.
What was the significance of your data?
Well, to me, what it showed is, I mean, one of the big problems we have here is the weather. That was the initial problem. We didn't have enough clear days. We had a lot of cloudy days, and the point was that you had to be seeing trails on the time lapse, and then you had to compare that with a clear day where there were no trails. But what the essence, in very quick summary of what I found, was that on average, on the days when we had a lot of trails, there was actually a small decrease in the number of detected aircraft, right? Which is absolutely counterintuitive. So because, essentially the software was picking up these aircraft and counting them, you would expect that when you saw all these trails, the automatic, you know, sort of intuitive assumption would be, we've got all these trails, that must mean there are more aircraft in the sky on that day, because it's these military planes, you know, whatever, dumping the stuff out, and we should be able to detect them. But I didn't find that. I did not find that. I wasn't able to prove that. What I tried to do, for example, was identify which planes, you know, were leaving the trails. And on a couple of cases, maybe like 5, I think I've got in the report that I managed to determine, I could actually identify the plane that was leaving the trail. And I'd already done this in 2010 with the AirNav radar box. I was lucky because I managed to whip out with my Canon SX20, which had a 20x optical zoom camera, a 20x optical zoom lens and a 12 megapixel sensor. I was able to photograph an EasyJet flight. Now, EasyJet is a budget UK airline that runs cheap flights to Europe mainly. It doesn't do transatlantic flights. And I was able to grab with the tracker, with the AirNav radar box, was not with Raspberry Pi. And then this is, I've put this on my website as well, so people can go and look at it. I got two EasyJet flights within an hour of each other, same day, I think it was the 5th of March, I think it was, 2010. Same day, same type of plane, same airline, EasyJet, same height in the sky, both UK domestic flights. One was leaving a big long trail right down to the horizon, and one wasn't. So something was clearly going on with that. All the factors were the same in these flights, but one of them was leaving a trail and one of them wasn't. And I wrote to EasyJet, the airline, and presented them with this information, gave them the aircraft number, the flight number, source and destination, blah, blah, blah. They said, we can't answer your operational query. Wouldn't answer the question. So I got no answer to that. Few more occasions with the Raspberry Pi, I was able to identify some of the flights that were actually leaving the trails. And these were on the time-lapse, so I could see from where the camera was pointing what they were. So the results were essentially somewhat inconclusive, really, which is kind of what I expected, because knowing that these ADS-B scanners had been around for a number of years, and, you know, I discovered this whole project on Raspberry Pi, which was, you know, based on the ADS-B scanning idea, that was all done, you know, probably a year or 2 years before I even came to it, and nobody had used this to, nobody had said, oh, you know, we've picked up all these planes leaving chemtrails, you know, and blah, blah, blah. It was kind of too obvious that would have been done, that would have been able to be scanned that way. So it's more complicated than that. I think one of there were two things that come to my mind right now which I thought were very, very useful. I had a tracker running at my brother's house. He lives in the northwest of England. It's about 90 miles from here, but about 70 miles as the crow flies. And on the 25th of November, this is all in the report, he had a massive day of trailing. There were trails from about 7 o'clock in the morning to, you know, sunset, about 4 in the afternoon or something. Loads and loads of trails, and I got the time lapse for the whole day. This was one of the rare occasions where I got trails, I got the trackers didn't crash, the time lapse all worked properly. Brilliant. But I could not identify, in other words, there were several grids that were formed on this time, and you can clearly see these grids on the time lapse. But on my charts, on these plotted charts where the Raspberry Pi had drawn out where these aircraft went, there were no grids. You couldn't see any grid patterns at all. So this means that whatever planes were making those grids were not detectable under ADS-B. These were not...
Yeah, they were probably military then, right?
I don't know. That would be the logical conclusion, but I can't, you know, I don't have any evidence that that's the case. In other words, one thing I haven't spoken about is ADS-B and the military aircraft, which is a little bit of a murky area, which I haven't quite got to the bottom of. What I did find out is that, and you'll see this in the report that I wrote about it, it's called Report on the Pi Sky Tracker. It's called A Systematic Attempt to Count Aircraft with a Raspberry Pi Computer-Based System. I forget the exact title. It's quite a long title.
Is it in the geoengineering
It's in the chemtrails and climate section of my website, yeah. If you go into that, there's little sections on the right-hand side, and you'll find it in there. But if anybody wants, you know, just write to me, and I'll. If they can't find it on there or searching through Google or whatever, just send me an email, and I'll send you the link and everything. One of the key findings as well, the problem with the ADS-B thing is, or I don't know if it's a problem with the ADS-B or Raspberry Pi or the aerial or what it is, but if you can when you get these signals from the aircraft, it gives you the height and it gives you the aircraft's call sign. Sometimes it doesn't give you the latitude and longitude. Those are the two figures that you use to track the aircraft. And I think on average, only about 40% of the packets that you pick up or the aircraft that you pick up give you the position. All right. So there are about 60% of these aircraft that for some reason, either the tracker is not picking up the latitude and longitude, or the aircraft is not broadcasting it. I don't know which what the reason is. I wasn't quite able to get to the bottom of this. So there is this unknown, you know, quantity, and what that was one of the other figures I was tracking as well. In other words, I wanted to see whether the ratio between the number of aircraft that had position of the, you know, the total number that were counted and the number that didn't have position, I wanted to see if that ratio changed. In other words, one might consider, for example, on the days of trailing, there would be more aircraft that weren't broadcasting their position to, you know, to me, so I wouldn't know where they were. I only know that they're within a range of about 25 miles, right? But again, that was inconclusive. I wasn't definitely able to say that on the days when there were lots of trails, I got more aircraft which didn't broadcast their position. In other words, were not traceable. So that again was inconclusive.
Is there a regulation or something that, or some technical data that you can find that will indicate what is the norm for aircraft? Are they, you were saying that they normally send out this information on a minute basis?
It's quite a few times a second, because they do this probably about 5 or 10 times a second, because, you know, you when your aircraft's moving at 500 miles an hour, you do want pretty fast updates. You can look at so I don't know. You see, when I was looking at the software which decodes these messages, you can see some of the comments in the C code, and it sort of says, it says something like, we'll try this method of decoding, and then if that method doesn't work, we'll try this method of decoding. It's as if, you know, whatever radio reception is being used, it's not 100% reliable. There's some, you know, way of decoding them more reliably, and I don't know whether that's just to do with when this thing runs at an airport, you know, they have a more sensitive receiver, you know, proper, obviously, commercial standard receiver. It may be to do with that, because obviously when you're using a 10 quid, you know, dongle, maybe the radio receiver is just like pretty basic and prone to picking up more error signals, or hasn't got as good signal to noise ratio and this sort of thing. So I was never really quite able to get to the bottom of that. It may be that if, for example, I reran this project with a better receiver, a more expensive receiver or something like that, I might get a slightly different set of results.
What about connecting it to an antenna?
It might, having a better aerial might, but then again, The I was only concerned, you see, the actual range of the aerial was actually quite long. If you had the aerial high up, I had one on a house, receiver in a house which was on a hill. You know, it was probably a few hundred feet above sea level, maybe 500-600 feet above sea level. I'm about 125 feet above sea level here, I think, where I live. And this could pick up aircraft from about over 100 miles away. The most distant aircraft that was picked up on it, I think, was 168 miles. Whereas my receiver was only picking up aircraft within about 40 miles. But the thing is that when you're looking for the trails, you can only see the trails from aircraft within a range of about 25 miles anyway. So any aircraft that you're detecting outside of that are useless to my study, because I can't see them, if you see what I mean. So I'm not really interested in detecting the aircraft that are a long way off. I'm interested in detecting the aircraft that I can actually optically see, because I can then photograph them or, you know, you do the time-lapse footage. So the aerial issue, I think, was less important, but it may be important in terms of getting a better quality signal rather than, you know, from a greater distance away, perhaps. So I didn't have chance to experiment with different types of aerial. What I do know is that from my knowledge of radio signaling, you know, I did physics as part of my degree, and I didn't do radio, but I do know, for example, what a half-wave dipole is, which is basically if you want to receive a radio signal of a certain wavelength, you need an aerial, which is half a wave. That's one of the optimum lengths to have that. So if you've got a VHF radio, which is, you know, for normal FM transmissions, your aerial ends up being about, I think, between 1 and 2 meters length, which is the optimum length. But for a higher frequency signal, which is a shorter wavelength, such as 1.04 gigahertz, which is ADS-B, you need a much shorter aerial. So the one that came with the unit was about the right length. It was about the optimum length for 1 gigahertz signal. So I ran these trackers all in the UK. I wanted to get some in other countries, but I wasn't really giving these things away because the tracker kits were costing me about $100-$120 a time. But I did loan out 5 kits to various people, and I mean I've got them all back now because they ran for about 9 months. But I didn't really get anyone that was sufficiently, au fait with the tech side, to set it up in another country. Unfortunately, this is something that could still be done. There is room for improving on this project. There are definitely improvements. I put some ideas in the document that I wrote about this, to how it can be improved, added to. I've still got quite a lot of data that I've gathered, a couple of gigabytes of data, which I haven't even looked at, frankly, because it was very, very time consuming to go through the videos, you know, count all the trails. You have to look at the time lapse, count when you see a trail. Is that a trail? Is that not a trail? Does it count? Is that a cloud? Is it a trail? You know, you went through that process, and it is very time consuming. I did get a little bit of help with that. Thankfully, I got some volunteers to help me count the trails. I sent them the time-lapse footage, and they would count the trails for me, and then send that back in a spreadsheet.
I mean, wow! I mean, just this. I mean, this an incredible program.
Well,
made it.
Well, I did because you see, going back to 9/11 for a moment, a lot of people are saying lots of things without having the evidence to back it up. You know, some of it they do, you know, and stuff, but a lot of it they don't. And that's, I'd come to that point a lot with the chemtrail research, that a lot of people making all these claims, and the evidence that you could get hold of, sometimes it was sort of highly suggestive, and sometimes it just wasn't there. So I wanted to bring it down to some basic observations, and when I started to do this, you know, yeah, okay, people have photographed the trails. They photographed them, they've put many YouTube videos, and a few people have done, they've used we haven't mentioned plainfinder.net and these websites. I'm sure there'll be a few people in the chat room have typed links by now. There are several websites which I haven't mentioned yet. There's plainfinder.net, there is Flight Radar 24, there's Virtual Radar, and I think there's one or two others. And you can put in your geographic location into the, you know, put it in as a latitude, longitude, or postcode, or zip code. It'll show you aircraft which are over your house, you know. Plainfinder.net will do it.
Commercial aircraft or both military?
Well, I think it's commercial only. I'm still a bit in the dark about the military thing. Because it's not, you do occasionally get on the ADS-B, for example, I picked up a flight called Snoop 55, which was a military flight, and it appeared to be, I think it was, I'm trying to remember from that, I think it was some type of, it gave you the model of the plane that on there, and it was definitely some type of military plane, but it didn't give you the location. So it will pick up some military flights on the Raspberry Pi and on the NAV radar box, but you tend not to get the latitude and longitude. You don't get all the information. So yes, there is potential for saying the flights that you're not detecting are military flights. That could be right. I wasn't able to prove that, but you know that could be right. But I wanted to see, you know, for example, sorry, I just had to cough there. I wanted to see.
Yeah, no problem.
if I could establish whether civilian, you know, because people have made claims about civilian airliners being involved. You'll see various claims and some YouTube videos saying, you know, this is a an American Airlines flight leaving a trail or a Greek Airlines flight leaving a trail. I wanted to see how much of that I could really pin down. And the answer was not a great deal. And you know, unless you're prepared to sit out and watch the sky, you know, for hours on end, for days on end, with a high zoom digital camera, holding your mobile phone in your hand with planefinder.net on it or something, it's going to be very tricky that you're going to be out just at the right time to see this flight going over, leaving a trail and photographing it. It's actually very tricky. So in other words, if you want, you know, and the point about this is, I mean, one of the things we spoke about, Brian, briefly, and I know you wanted to get into touch with Josefina Martin, didn't you, about the European initiatives and so forth?
Yeah, engineering, yeah, right. Yeah.
And so if you're going to go to whoever it is, European Parliament, you know, US Congress, whoever it might be, EPA, you're going to need some evidence that what you're saying is true. You're going to need to say, well, look, we've got, you know, X, Y, Z instances of X, you know, A, B, and C airlines leaving trails on this day, that day, and this day. Here's a photograph. Here's the video. Here's the dump of ADS-B. This proves that, you know, this is a problem. You need to investigate this. That you need this sort of evidence, right? And I will openly admit that what I did, you know, there's ways that it can be done better. Somebody, for example, suggested that it can be tied in with humidity data, which I didn't have at the time. So you could look at the humidity levels in the atmosphere, because that apparently is available, and I haven't done that. But you know, you need to stack this evidence up and measure things, count things, and so that you can take that ultimately into a some type of legal forum. Or it can be presented to somebody who's going to listen, basically. And that was essentially my goal, to see if I could do that.
Well, you did do it. I thought you did it on a few occasions, like you mentioned, that you had two flights, same carrier, same size plane, same altitude, all that good stuff. So they're basically twin flights. And one had a trail and one didn't. So, and you didn't get an answer from
correct,
the airline.
Correct.
As to why.
No, you know, I'm not. I didn't pursue that. I didn't really know where to go from there with that, because when you've just got one instance like that, it's easy to obviously to sweep that under the rug or just be palmed off. I'd previously been palmed off when I'd asked about the grid over my house. You know, I mean, to me, these grids are a big mystery. You know, I don't know if we truly are being sprayed with barium and aluminium. I know a lot of people say that, and I've spoken a bit about that myself. It's in the presentation that I did in October, and I've read about this for years and years. But actually proving that is actually very difficult. It's far more difficult than you think. Well, I would say because.
Well, yeah, the thing is that the military have all the eggs in their basket, because they're going to say, well, we're not going to let people track our flights. This is confidential security-related information, right? So I'm almost certain that you'll have a hard time getting the military to cooperate in terms of giving you the ability to track their
right,
planes.
Right, exactly. And to me, the grids remain a big mystery, and I put that in the report. Why these grids appear, there's no explanation. Does it mean that those are grids of toxic chemicals? I don't. And my honest answer is I don't know. But I've been seeing these grids for 10 years now, right? And I've seen them. I've got photographs, many photographs of them from right over my house. And I'm not dying of.
I see them every day, man.
Right,
I see them
right,
every
and
day.
I've heard other people saying this.
I live near right. Lake Ontario in Canada, and it's an ideal vantage point to see these things. And lately it's been pretty sunny. Mm-hmm. Haven't had hardly any rain the last – it's spring too, which is unusual. But we haven't had a lot of rain, but wow, lots of trailing going on.
Yeah.
Probably 10, 15 a day. Some days I'll get up early, walk the dog, and there won't be any. I'll go out a few hours later and there'll be 10 in the sky. So it just
depends. I think one of the huge problems is, and it's same with 9/11 evidence as well – you can clearly see there is something going on. You know, you can clearly see, you look at these grids, you look at the circles, you look at these anomalous cloud formations, you know, and people say, people will say, you read this, oh, it's pareidolia. You know, this is the word where you make up patterns in your mind, you know, where you look at a cloud and it looks like a teddy bear or a, you know, a penguin or something. That's pareidolia. And, but the grids is a completely different issue, you know, and to me, what seems to be going on in anybody's mind that's in government or any, the EPA or any of the UK equivalents, there's the opposite of pareidolia. In other words, there is this inability to see obvious patterns, obvious anomalies, which should not be there, you know, and they will not see it and they will not talk about it. And this is a huge problem.
Well, I'll tell you something else that happened. I called the weather station nearby when I first got into this about 3 years ago, and I asked the meteorologist to take a look outside at these things. I didn't actually get to him directly. They wouldn't let me talk to the meteorologist, which is kind of curious, but I did send him a few email, and for 2 weeks I didn't see one trail in the sky. And I thought that was an interesting correlation.
Again, you've picked on another mystery there, Brian. This is something, if, you know, whichever way you look at it, let's say we are being poisoned, just as a lot of people are saying. You know, I know you had this show with Dame Wigginton, which we discussed, and that's what he was saying. And he's not the only one. Don't get me wrong. I know that.
Oh, no. It's generally the consensus belief in the geoengineering community that there's a number of nefarious. I sent you that movie, The Secret.
Oh, yeah. The Secret Chemtrails, The Secret War. We'll maybe have a little chat about that. Yeah.
Whatever. And, you know, they offered about six different possible, it aids with communication, having all these particles in the air, you know, all that kind of stuff. But there's lots of, some of them are less nefarious than others.
Right. I mean, that's a typical film as well. I mean, I'll perhaps chat about that a bit later. I mean, you should mention, like, for example, Cliff Carnicom, who appears to have done a lot of research into this whole field since, I think, about 1999, 1998. He was one of the very first people, and I found his research very interesting. But, you know, you set a mystery right there. You say you don't see your trails for 2 weeks, which is the same as happens here. You know, so
And they're less evident in the north. I tend to travel around a lot. Because I like to ski at the best mountain in the wintertime, and I go up to Mont Tremblant, which is, 500 miles from here, about 700 kilometers, which is about 450 for my American listeners, miles. And I see maybe one or two a day up there, never more than one or two a day. And I'm always looking at the sky. I'm just so fascinated with this issue. I mean, there isn't a day I don't look at the sky.
Yeah, you know, and this is part of the mystery in the why does it seem to be certain areas at certain times? And if it is this poisoning program, then, you know, why this sort of strange timetable for it? You know, and this is one of the questions that nobody really asks and nobody really sort of delves into very much in my experience. I mean, I don't have an answer for that myself.
Do you know anyone who says there's no chemtrails in their part of the world?
I don't, basically. People have written to me from most places, most continents, I think, now, and said they've either sent me pictures, you know, because that grid thing that I talked about, the grid, that picture that I took, ever since I had that posted, I had people writing to me for the last 10 years, basically. And I've got, you know, had tens of gigabytes of stuff sent to me on DVD and things like that. So yeah, it's all over the place. It's all over the place. And I still don't know what the true answer is. One thing I would like to mention is this, what I mentioned it in that report that I did as well, is this idea of, let's try and prove up this idea that we're getting barium and aluminium being spat out of the back of aircraft and, you know, into the atmosphere. And when I was in Europe. Oh, we're coming up to the music. Okay.
Oh, it sounds like we're getting our first break. Alrighty. Coming up here, Andrew. So we'll just continue this very interesting discussion after the break. It's about 5 minutes. And thanks so much, folks, for listening to Iron Nature. We'll be back soon. Welcome one and all back to I Am Nature. I'm your host, Brian Porter, and I have Andrew Johnson with me, researcher from Britain. Now, before we get back to Andrew, there's something I wanted to announce. It's a very interesting conference coming up. It's happening in Summertown, Tennessee, a small town in Tennessee. It's being sponsored by the Farm Conference on Community and Sustainability, May 22 to 24, and that's the Memorial Weekend, Memorial Day weekend down there in the U.S. So I thought I'd announce that. My show, we talk a lot about getting involved in sustainability, living in communities where they grow all their own food. They create their own energy. Let's see, what do we got here? They're saying they'll show you their sustainable food production system, 89 kilowatts in solar installations, learn about alternative education, conflict resolution, land trust, midwifery, and so much more. So it's part of the Fellowship of Intentional Communities, 2,050 strong, folks. There's over 1,700 in the U.S. alone. So this is an incredible network that I encourage all my listeners to connect with, because you're going to learn so much by associating with them. And now, also, I'd like to put in a plug for the station. You know, Revolution Radio is the largest listener-sponsored internet radio on the planet, and we have 80 or so hosts putting out very vital information that you won't hear on the mainstream media. And we do love your support, and you've been very supportive for the last 5 years, but you've got to continue to offer us what I'd like to do is suggest people come up with a number, whether it's $5 a month or $10. We have a membership plan. We have seed packs where you can get your garden going or grow indoors or whatever, micro grow. There's all sorts of things you can do with seeds, and you can buy ads on the site. So I'm hoping that my listeners will – oh, the other thing, the best part, the best way to support the station and the best way for you to retain the information that's being given on this station is to get into the archive program for $5 a month. You have access to 48 hours a day of shows, practically. There's a bit of overlap, but it's I'd say maybe 36 hours of shows a day. It's incredible. I mean, you could never listen to it all, but we all have our favorite hosts, our favorite shows. So I'm hoping you'll get access to the archives. Again, $5 a month, and everything you would ever want to listen to is available to you. So, okay, so let's get back to our very special guest, Andrew Johnson. Are you still
I'm still
with
here.
Us? All right. I just have to check in. You know, these Skype connections, they break down all the time. Yeah. So, yeah, we were chatting a bit. I think you – have you had any debates with more fundamental kind of like geoengineers, people who believe that – these trails they feel they have enough evidence to conclude that these trails are chemical.
I've had a lot of debates over the last few years of various types. I've had no formal recognition from anybody that there is anything going on. I think perhaps what I felt moved to discuss next in relation to this was the time I went to the European Parliament, which was just 2 years ago, actually just over 2 years ago now, and we'd spoken, I think, you know, before we did this interview, about Josefina Fry Martin, a Spanish lady, and she'd organised this meeting within the European Parliament to talk about chemtrails, or it was called...
Yeah, conference. Was it a weekend conference?
There was an evening film showing of Michael Murphy's What in the World Are They Spraying film. They showed that at about 7:30 in the evening and invited various Euro MPs to the film. I think one or none showed up, of course. And then the next day we had, I think was it a morning and afternoon, I'm trying to remember how long it was. But we had some time the next day in one of the European Parliament sessions, you know, and they had translators there translating what we were saying, and one of the other speakers that Josefina invited was speaking in German, I think, and I put my headset on and I was able to press the button for English, you know, and it was, I was able to hear it in English. So it was, it, you know, it was done properly as far as I could work out. It was very poorly attended. But I did meet Michael Murphy there at that event. He was, he gave a little speech in the evening and he gave another couple of speeches and answered questions on the second day. So it was a very interesting event. But one of the things which I wanted to mention, and I'd like to know what's happened to this, if anybody knows. Last time I checked, it hadn't really gone anywhere, but I was shown by one of the other conference delegates, called Saskia. She showed me this film that had been given to her just to, she, it wasn't going to be put on the internet at that point because the chap who'd made it, who was called, Matthias Hanke, he'd got this light aircraft which could go up to quite a high altitude. It could go up to like 25, 30,000 feet. And he had flown into a trail of an aircraft to get a sample, and he brought a sample back to his, wow, to a laboratory and tested it, you know, for the chemicals. And apparently what I was told, Saskia showed us this clip just on her laptop when we were sat in the foyer of the hotel. And it was a little video that he'd done where he, you know, showed the plane going up and bringing the sample back. And but apparently what happened is the sample had got contaminated, so he wasn't happy that, you know, he got a successful sample. And so he needed to do it again. And I think he wanted, what he wanted to do was make a proper film about it. There were some problems and, he, you know, the guy who'd agreed to use the plane couldn't use it anymore or something, or moved or something. But he, so he needed to raise some money to make a short film about this, what he was going to do. And it was going to be called Overcast. And I think, yeah, I did put some money into this. This was about a year or so ago, at least, no, probably 2 years ago now. But I never heard anything. And this would be the thing that would, you know, be very important to do. That go up, get a sample, bring it back, test it in a laboratory. What are the chemicals in it? Have we got the barium? Have we got the aluminium? Meaning what the quantities be,
and whatever fluoride,
other things have been suggested. Now I know that people have tested rainwater, and the results that I've seen are a bit of a mixed bag. I mean, there's a Chemtrails Project UK website. I went clicked on there a couple of days ago, and they've got several sets of rainwater results that they've posted on there, because they sell a kit at a modest price. I think it's like about $30 for a rainwater testing kit, about 24 English pounds or something. And they've posted these results, but if you look at these results, they're a very mixed bag. You know, they're all over the place. They haven't plotted them on a graph or anything. So it seems of limited usefulness. But if you could go up and get this from a trail in the sky, then you haven't got these other problems with whether it's coming from a factory or, you know, whether it's runoff rainwater that's being collected and not rainwater that's come straight down, you know, and stuff like this. So, but that doesn't seem to have gone anywhere. And what's more been happening is, Angela's typed is due to come out in future. Yeah, in the near future. Oh, well, that's good then, if that's still coming out. Because I hadn't heard it. When I looked on the Facebook page, I hadn't seen any updates for, I think, about a year or something. So maybe I need to go and look at that again, or...
Who's making this movie?
Matthias Hanke. I can't remember the exact spelling of his name, but I'll try and type it in the chat window. It's Matthias, I think it's relatively easy to spell, and it's Hanke or Hanckee. I can't remember the exact spelling of his name.
Well, I'll try to track it down.
Yeah.
It sounds like a great initiative, because... I see, the reason I thought nobody had done it before is because these jets, these military aircraft, I think principally we're dealing with military aircraft here. This is just my assumption, and it's sort of what suggested by your data, that a lot of these trails are not showing up because they're not domestic flights.
It's sort of suggested by that. Yeah, I mean, I'm a bit hesitant to say that, but yeah.
It doesn't prove it, but it just pushes us in a certain direction. And but how do you keep up with these guys? I mean, I see some of these flights. You can barely see the plane, and they cover the horizon in about 3 minutes.
That would actually have a good point there, because another thing would be to measure the speed. Now, you know, that might be doable. if you have the right type of equipment, if you've got a ground, I don't know whether you could get a ground LiDAR detector, because it may be that the plane is a bit lower than you're expecting, so it seems to be going over faster, you know, and it's not quite as way up there as you think. But yeah, I know what you mean, though. Nevertheless, some of these flights do seem to go very, very quickly, and it's, you know.
Oh yeah, right. No, I can tell. Right. I can tell. I think there is some. I think with the domestic planes, I think it's more like something in the fuel that's doing it. And then I think with the military, my guess is that it's. I'm not. You know, like I say, I'm not as. I'm not. I am concerned about geoengineering. It's one of my. I call them seven planet killers. But I would like to see more and more corroborative evidence to corroborate what Dana's saying and Michael's saying all over the planet, you see, because most of what they've done has been in California, in the area that he lives in. I think there's been some corroboration in other places, but he seems to have the most damning data. He seems to come up with
I think we've got to be very careful how we interpret that data as well, because I heard the interview he did with Dana, most of it. And, you know, it was, and I've mentioned this in the talk that I did about David Keith's research, where he talks about using barium titanate discs, I think 10 microns in thickness or something, as a reflective layer, doing this what they call solar radiation management, SRM. And we had this whole set of conferences in the UK about this, two of which I attended and one of which Josefina attended as well. And we did a sort of intervention. And there's quite a lot I could talk about on that side of things, but I want to talk about disinformation, because it's very important that people understand that there are people putting out deliberately false information. For example, and I put this in my 2015 presentation, you'll see these pictures claiming that chemtrail tanks have been photographed inside a plane. And this has been around the internet for 3 or 4 years now, and there's like one of these Dayglo jackets draped over a seat, and then arrows pointing to these tanks, which is allegedly the chemtrail fluid. And this is not true. This is not what this is. This is not what this picture is. This picture is from a test flight. And I've got pictures from another test flight, which I think is from a Boeing 777 test flight, which was done in 2005. And you can see the same tanks, but not only can you see the tanks, you can see civilian members of the public walking around the plane when the plane has landed onto the ground from after a test flight. And there's a whole blog about this explaining what it is. And when you have the aircraft under test, you have to, as I understand it, you have to simulate the load on the airframe so that, you know, if all the luggage was at the back of the plane and all the passengers were at the front or something, you know, it wouldn't be too unstable, so it became, you know, impossible to fly. So you pump this fluid around the aircraft in these tanks, I think, to simulate where the passengers are sitting or, you know, where the load is, so that you know that you can deal with it, and that's how you flight test it, or one of the elements of the flight test. So there's disinformation being put out about that, and then we'll get onto this secret war film.
Well, it's not absolutely confirmed, but it could be chem spraying too. I mean, you're saying they do have these planes they use to test for load-bearing abilities and a shifting in weight. They use the tanks to move liquids around so they can, see how stable they are under different conditions and stuff. So, they are. But they could also be chemical sprays. I mean, you get people like that woman who used to work for the military who came out. Oh,
I've written about her. But if you listen to what she actually says, there is very little information which wasn't already on the internet. You know, there's very, very little that she actually says, and most of the, in fact, A.C. Griffith, he died a couple of years ago. I listened to an interview with him on the Power Hour, and it was the same with him. He said, oh, we got right into this chemtrail program, and I think this interview is still on YouTube somewhere. And if you listen to the whole interview, there is no other information, you know, that wasn't already out there. He doesn't come out with anything that's verifiable. And that's part of the problem. And, you know, we hear about things like Project Cloverleaf, but we don't have any corroboration for that. And if you actually try and get detailed information with names, you know, ranks, serial numbers, it's very, very hard to come by. Very hard to come by. I've watched quite a few of these whistleblower testimonies. I'm not saying, well, I don't know what to say about them. All I can say is that you don't seem to be able to verify the evidence. What I am saying is, clearly, there is something going on, you know, and
You're not willing to say definitively what it is, but there's something happening. Now, this is something else that I want to speak to you about, because you seem to think that we can change the climate quite dramatically. Maybe we could talk a bit now about, you have a fascinating view of 9/11, and I didn't realize this until I met you, which is, I'm really glad you brought this up and informed me about this, that there was a hurricane right offshore around the time of 9/11, and it took a beeline right. I mean, I've never seen a hurricane turn so fast in all my life. And so you do seem to think that they do have an ability to play with
that's
the weather.
That's a great lead-in, because what I think is going on is we've got a lot of people talking about spraying, toxicity, you know, dumbing down, all that kind of stuff. I call that fear porn. And we see it in many fields of research of the alternative knowledge community. Dollars come in to, you know, put everybody into FEMA camps or whatever. You know, I'm not saying that that's not going to happen, and I do agree there is an agenda which looks like that's what they are trying. It very much looks like that, and we've seen, you know, legislation coming through, and all of that stuff. I'm aware of all of that, but what if a lot of the fear porn is keeping people in a state of fear, so that they are unable to see other things which are going on? And you said it right there. You'd never heard of Hurricane Erin. Now, that information was first published by Dr. Judy Wood in 2008, April 2008. That's 7 years ago, right? And I'm going to ask you a rhetorical question. How long have you been following what's being called chemtrails? You know, how long?
About 3 years now.
Right. 3.5 years. So for 3.5 years, you've been looking at chemtrail stuff, geoengineering stuff, but it wasn't until last week that you heard about Hurricane Erin. Now, would you agree at all that would indicate that's a successful cover-up?
Well, yeah, I think a lot of things.
Because, remember, you're some...
Very successful.
It's very successful because...
What methodology do you agree with? I mean, but it was obviously a false flag.
I know, but what I want to point out is the way that information is being got to people, right? And the information that's getting to people's consciousness and the information that isn't. Now, you've had information about chemtrails getting into your consciousness for 3.5 years, yet you haven't had knowledge of this hurricane, which is easily verifiable. You don't need a whistleblower. You don't need Kristen Meghan. She's never spoken about it. I don't think Dane Wigginton's ever spoken about it. We started speaking about that information because Dr. Judy Wood discovered it in 2008. That's 7 years ago, right? And to tell people a bit more about that hurricane so that they know and they can check it, it was given a name. It was the longest-lasting hurricane of the 2001 season. It was given a name... Erin, on around about the 1st of September. It was a tropical storm. It moved across the Atlantic, went up to Bermuda, hit Bermuda on the 7th of September, did a bit of damage there, and it was, I think it went up to a high-grade tropical storm and then down a bit and then back up. And CNN reported that damage in Bermuda at that time on the 7th of September or next day or whatever, and then it went in a straight line for 4 days towards New York City. And I've got a list of text messages which I think came originally from WikiLeaks, which were sent to mobile phones on the morning of 9/11, and that includes some people who subscribed to weather warnings. And Hurricane Erin was being warned in these text messages, I think, up until about, oh, was it 10 o'clock in the morning? I forget the exact time. And then the warning stopped. Yet that hurricane had been traveling towards New York City in a straight line for 4 days. And at 8 o'clock in the morning on 9/11, it was the closest to New York City. And then on the it was moving at its slowest travel as a storm system throughout the events of 9/11. It was a Category 3 storm. It was a significant storm. And then 12th September, moved off out towards Newfoundland. Now, there are two possibilities. Either that was a coincidence, or it wasn't. And I would...
Oh, I mean, it was a sharp turn, man.
Yes.
I mean, it was unbelievable.
And not only that, but you look at other factors which are on Dr. Judy Wood's website, because she studied, for example, the humidity, the air pressure, and several aspects of weather data. I think all of these were constant throughout the events of 9/11, right? And dry thunder was reported at all three New York airports, JFK, LaGuardia, and Newark. So they had thunder there, which means that the electrical influence of that storm system reached as far as all three New York airports, all right? That fact has gone unreported by nearly all 9/11 Truth websites and nearly all geoengineering related websites. They do not talk about it. I've been talking about it since 2008, and I put it into that report that you read and into the presentations that I've done, because I think it's an indication that this was an actively moved storm system.
No, but if the geoengineers want to make this point that they can change the weather and do it quite profoundly, why would they not be mentioning this?
You tell me. I don't know the reason. To me, it is one of the best pieces of evidence of geoengineering. Now, that's actually been done already, and I think there are probably several others. I mean, for example, you can look at Dutch Sense. He's got some very interesting YouTube videos where he's tracked some of the storm systems, both over the US and some of the typhoons in the Far East. I think he's had a couple of good videos about that. Some very, very unusual traces. And I've collected some radar weather traces from another site, going back to 1999, where you've got these circular radar rings, all of this stuff. And those sorts of things get discussed far less than the chemtrail stuff. The weather anomalies that appear on these radar traces and on these other mimic traces that you can download. Cloud anomalies don't get discussed as much. I was able to capture some cloud anomalies with my time-lapse footage on Raspberry Pi, which I've written up in the report. Two or three I got on there, which are very intriguing. So I think that this whole talk of geoengineering being done with chemtrails and spraying, I think that's a distraction. I think it's related, but that is not the active mechanism by which they are already geoengineering the weather. To me, geoengineering is already going on, right? And I think it's far more likely that a lot of the trails, maybe not all of them, but a substantial number of them are being seen because they are the side effect of ongoing geoengineering, not the cause, right? And I think that is possibly, and I'm not 100% certain of this, it's possibly one of the biggest mistakes that people are making, right?
So you think that the trail itself, I was thinking about this today because you, you're quite a fan, I believe you're a fan of Judy Wood's book, her theory of direct energy weapons being used.
It's not a theory. She writes about evidence, and I've written a whole book about how her book has been covered up and what's in that book. I've written a whole book about that, which is what I spoke a little bit about on Rush.
Yeah. I think it's genius. I think it's it's like the same thing with chemtrails. I mean, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, I'm very close to believing in it, but it made me think maybe these trails are caused by some sort of weapon system on the planet.
It's possible.
Between this weapon system and the
atmosphere. I think what you can see, I mean, and it doesn't, you know, if you just remove chemtrails or the aircraft trail from the equation for a moment, just look for cloud anomalies and strange sort of weather patterns, which I think everyone has observed, you know, and these weird temperature changes, you know, where it's, and we had all that snow, I think, in New York area, didn't we? The most snow ever that's fallen in 24 hours in anywhere in the continental US. I think that happened in, what was it, October last year or November or something. And we've had,
Buffalo,
that's right.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm literally an hour's drive from Buffalo, and we got about half an inch of snow, and they got
Yeah, there you go. And you're getting lots of instances like that. And I think there was one year, I think it was 2012, 2013, where more weather records were broken than any other year. It was a record-breaking weather year. And I think that what's going on is that the people that are running the planet, whoever they are, you know, they're screwing you left, right, and center. They're screwing you financially, health-wise, and they're screwing you with the weather as well. They've got that control over the weather. And I think this ties into the research of Wilhelm Reich, right? Because that's what he was looking at with Cloudbusters, Orgo and Energy. He was completely shut down in the 50s, and he ended up dead. And, you know, very few people link Reich's research to geoengineering. Very few. It's a very small number that talk about that. And I've not heard many of the chemtrail researchers talk about it, except for those that have bought and used these so-called chem busters or cloud busters, which you can make. And there's instructions how to do that on Don Croft's site and various other places. And I've reproduced that on my website. So I think this is all about keeping technology covered up, right? That's what 9/11 is clearly about. In terms of what happened at the World Trade Center, you aren't allowed, right? You're not even allowed in the alternative knowledge movement to talk about the technology. That's if you want to discuss that, you're not allowed to discuss it. Now let's get on to Dane Wigginton, because I have got an example.
Well, I think Judy Wood has been. I don't think she's been ostracized by the alternative news business. I don't think so. She's quite popular. Her book has been received.
Oh, well, that's not really true. And in fact, the book has been out since 2011. I mean, I've got a clip of Richard Gage, who's the sort of lead person in Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. He was interviewed by our friend Ralph Winterode in Alaska. And in that interview, when he was challenged about Dr. Judy Wood's book, he said, if she's going to ignore all of that evidence, meaning the evidence for bombs in the building and all the stuff that he talks about, she is not practicing science, she is practicing witchcraft. That's what he actually said. Yep, and I've got an audio clip of that.
Well, you know, I mean, it's unfortunate. This has been going on since Socrates. People tend to think they know more than they know. Instead of looking at the other evidence and being fair, people tend to say, I have all the answers. And if you disagree, there's no way they can find a way to compromise.
It goes beyond that. I mean, I started to talk about that in Royce's program, specifically with the Architects and Engineers group, for example. A few years ago, a disaffected member of the Architects and Engineers group came out of that group because he got fed up of all the bickering in committee meetings and so forth. And he wrote this book called Nano Management, The Breakup of a Truth Group or Truth Movement. I forget the exact title. And he initially gave that away as a free PDF about his experiences in the Architects and Engineers group and why it wasn't really working because of the way it was run. And in that book, and I posted this on a blog, this particular page, he'd reproduced the Architects and Engineers vetting procedures, right? In other words, when people sign up for their petition, the volunteers are asked to do email checks on these people and Facebook checks and see what other things they've got posted on their websites or Facebook pages or, you know, what other articles pop up. And they list a number of things, like if Zionism is listed or UFOs are listed or, you know, Bigfoot is listed, then that person shouldn't be, you know, considered to be credible and shouldn't be allowed to sign the petition. And there is also one of the other keywords two of the other keywords that are in that list of keywords that they've got to search for. There's only one person named in the whole of human history that they've got to vet for in the Architects and Engineers group. Do you know that who that person's name is? Judy Wood.
I know.
Right. That is she is the only named person in their vetting procedures. Why would that be, do you think? That's a rhetorical question. And I can prove that because that is on my blog, right?
So they won't let her join their movement?
They don't want her to join the movement. She wouldn't apply. She's not part of a movement. She is an independent researcher. You will hear her say on interviews she is not part of the truth movement because I would, neither am I really. I agree with her. Truth does not need a movement. If you want the truth, you look for it yourself, you look at the evidence, right? Truth needs people to talk about the evidence and stick to the evidence. And when people are not talking about Hurricane Erin when they're talking about geoengineering, you know, and they're not talking about the buildings turning to dust when they're talking about what happened to the World Trade Center, they're not talking about the evidence, right? So you cannot unify people who are not talking about the evidence with people who are talking about the evidence when those people who don't want to talk about the evidence have made it very, very clear they don't want to talk about it, right? And that's essentially what my book is about.
Yeah, but you said that Judy doesn't write off the idea of explosives being used to bring down the, as part of the problem.
Well, what I mean is, well, let's make it clear what I mean about that. You have to read her book to fully understand what I mean about that, right? Now, Richard Gage claims in this interview and elsewhere that Judy Wood ignores the evidence for thermite, right? And she ignores the evidence for bombs. But if you go and look at the contents page of her book, which I've reproduced on my website for everybody, you'll see that she's got, you know, subheadings in chapters of bombs, thermite, whatever, right? She's got all that covered in her book and explained. If we take the issue of bombs in the building, for example, she writes about that in her book, and she said that just because people heard sounds of explosions doesn't mean to say there were bombs. There can be many reasons for explosions. And one of the possible reasons, for example, is exploding tanks. What tanks could have exploded? How about fire extinguishers? In fact, that's in the witness reports of the firemen. The firemen, right, they were at the base of the building. They had air tanks, Scott packs, on their fire trucks. They were exploding outside the building. There's witness reports of that happening, right? That doesn't mean there were bombs on the fire truck. What it means is their pressurized tanks were exploding. And this was because of what was happening to the metal, or some of the metal, which was being affected by the field effects that were being impinged on the building. And that's all in the book. And if you read the whole book, you would understand that, and you would see what the evidence showed, right? But Richard Gage, he lies yeah. about that. What he says is she doesn't talk about that evidence. What she does is she does talk about the evidence, but she explains what it actually was, not what she thinks it was, right? Or not what...
Okay, the next question, Andrew, is this. Were there not confirmed residues of some sort of explosive in the dust from 9/11?
Not really. That's not been proved conclusively.
Engineers, and what do you call the engineers? What's that
Architects and engineers. Now, I talked a little bit about that on Royce's program. Now, the problem here is this. Stephen E. Jones, who is the physicist from Brigham Young University, he came out in 2005 and claimed that thermite, which isn't an explosive, it's an incendiary, had been found on the steel or in the dust, and that proved that thermite was used, right? And he claimed that he had this dust sample from Janet McKinley, and initially he claimed it was thermite. They had to add in the idea of explosive because they realised, and it's obvious, that thermite isn't an explosive. You look it up. It's an incendiary. Most people don't know, you see, what thermite is. Because I did some chemistry, I do know what thermite is. Thermite is it's the combination, I've said this many, many times, I have to repeat it thousands of times to people because they don't know. Thermite is the combination of iron oxide and aluminium powder, right? And when you put these two materials together and you put a hot fuse into them, you get what's called an oxidation reduction reaction, redox reaction, where the oxygen is taken from the iron to the aluminium, and it's a very hot, very powerful reaction which produces a very, very bright, hot flame, very bright yellow flame. And that should give you a clue. The thermite reaction gives a bright, hot, yellow flame, right? Extreme heat. That wasn't seen as the towers are coming down.
So you're saying that it should have lit
correct,
up like a
correct.
Like a
because
a bonfire
they, Niels Harriet, the Danish chemist, he says that there were tons of thermite in the building. You can go onto YouTube, you can look at a flower pot full of thermite reacting, right? Just put thermite reaction YouTube and you'll see it.
Yeah.
A flower pot is blinding, you know, it's blinding, and that's a flower pot full.
Yeah.
That's to melt one little, you know, at front of a car. They do it with the front of a car in this one example. Jones, now, people don't realize what the World Trade Center was made of necessarily. On the inside, you had steel girders. Steel girders are, steel is a form of iron, essentially, with carbon added in various specific quantities. If you stand a steel girder up in air for 30 years, what will it do? It'll rust, right? What's rust? It's iron oxide, right? What's the exterior of the World Trade Center, the shiny silvery exterior? It's an aluminium alloy, right? So what have you got when the World Trade Center turns to dust? You've got aluminium dust, and you've got iron oxide dust. What does that equal? Well, it equals thermite, folks. So that was why they needed that cover story. That was the cover story. They could say, oh, we found thermite in the dust, right? That's what took the building down.
Yeah, so Judy's view is that the thermite was created by the directed
No, the building, thermite wasn't created by the directed energy weapon. The building was essentially made of thermite, you know, not in its reactive form. So when it actually was turned to dust, you had aluminium dust, because that was from the aluminium exterior, and you had iron oxide dust from some of the rust on the steel girders. Of course, not all of the steel girders were rust, but they had a sufficient coating of rust, and there were many. There were about 280 steel girders in that building, each, you know, a quarter of a mile long, you know. So you would have had quite a bit of rust powder when that lot turned to dust. So that was a custom. The other thing that I pointed out is, if Stephen Jones had been honest in his statements, he would have put that research into his legal document, and he did not. He did not put the word thermite into his legal challenge to NIST, the request for correction. It wasn't in there, right? So why would that be? He knew, in other words, that this was not true, and it was misleading. And if he had put it into something which ended up into a legal submission, he could have been had up for fraud, because it's also fraudulent to put fraudulent evidence in a fraud case, which is what he would have been doing. And I've documented all of that on blogs and on my book, and it's quite clear what's going on. So, in summary, there's been a very, very clear and concerted effort to divert people away from the evidence of what's happened on 9/11, right, with various techniques and methods. And I think exactly the same sort of thing isn't quite as clear cut for me in the what's called the chemtrail geoengineering thing. I think that's going on with the chemtrail movement. That a lot of people have been diverted onto other things which aren't really what's going on. They're not the things that should be being focused on. That's what I think.
Right. Well, I mean, you strike me as being someone who believes in what they're saying, and you're trying to be scientific, and I applaud you for that.
May I interject and just say that the website is called checktheevidence.com, and appropriately titled, I might add. I'm just sitting back and taking in all this information, and it is just blowing me away. My hat's off to you for the amount of work that you have put into all of this, Andrew.
And I thank you for.
Great delivery, and truly check the evidence.
Thank you very much. I do really appreciate that. And there's just along those lines of what you're saying, one of the problems that we get when we're into this weird world that we're in now, you know, of looking at all this stuff, is that people they get confused between what is they actually know, what is knowledge, you know, and what they believe. And you've got to think about that very carefully. Think about what you know and what you believe, right? And that's what I try to make the distinction between. For example, we don't know who did 9/11, right? We can believe that it was, you know, George Bush and Dick Cheney. We could believe that might be true. We could believe that it was a bunch of Zionists, you know, that sort of set various things up and they helped talk. Or we could believe that it was Israel, but we don't know, right? We could believe that planes were hijacked, because that's what we heard on the news, and we could believe that Arabs did it, but we don't actually know. However, if you go and look at 40,000 pictures of what happened to the World Trade Center, including, you know, when it was being built, you know, just before it was destroyed on 9/11 and just after it was destroyed, you know, like pictures taken on the 12th, you don't have to believe anything. You can see what happened. You can know what happened. You can know that on September the 10th, those buildings were there, standing firm in the ground, and on the 12th, they were gone. You can clearly see that, you know, and then you can look at the videos and you can see those buildings turning to dust, and you can move from a position of belief to knowledge in that particular case. And there are other examples that you can cite too. So it's very important that people distinguish between what is belief and what is knowledge. And because of the way the mainstream media works, you know, we're sort of hypnotized into accepting things just without really thinking about it, those boundaries are very, very much blurred, you know. And it's, and I think it's a very important part of this, what we might call the waking up process, that you distinguish properly as best you can of what's in front of you between what is knowledge and what is belief, you know. And look at taking steps from what you know to what you can know, you know, in the next step, you know, that sort of thing. So.
Wow. And you were mentioning on the thank you, Brian, for letting me interject. You were mentioning that if people have you know, questions, et cetera, that they can contact you. Can they find you on your website, or did you want to give out an email address? What is the best?
Well, there's a contact button on the older pages on my website, on the main site anyway. There's so you can just click on that and fill that in. And I've put some spiel on there to try and sort of deflect some of the silly emails, and it seems to be fairly successful. But I'm on Facebook. People can catch me on Facebook. My email address is on various articles that are on there. info@checktheevidence.com will get to me as well. And, you know, I'm a public person. I give public talks, and I don't keep any of this a secret. I've never been threatened by anybody, and, you know, I don't try and hide what I do. Whenever I post on the internet, I always try and use my real name everywhere, because there's so much anonymity on the internet, and people all use these handles, and it's a huge problem. It's the anonymity on things like forums.
I don't. Great. I use my real name.
I'm so pleased to hear it.
And I can say, Andrew, that you are very accessible. I've had no problems talking to you on Skype. You've always, how many times have we chatted?
Oh, probably, yeah. I mean, we've exchanged quite a few chats in the last week or so, haven't we? Yeah, absolutely. Because I'm here, you know, I work at home, I basically go out, see these students, do the reports, and I'm at home quite a lot, you know. I've got two children that live with me, and my wife's here, so, you know, this is where I spend my time, you know. So yeah, I'm pretty accessible. I talk to anyone that wants to know more, or happy to chat to people. About what I've come to know and understand, and I'll also chat about what I don't know and I don't understand, you know. So either way. But I mean, you know, well, I just maybe mention what Dame Wigginton said, because I mean, Dame Wigginton, I've not spoken to Dane. I've listened to him a few times. I saw him in Michael Murphy's film, the first one. I saw Dane in.
What in
That's
the world
right,
of the spring,
yeah. And
see, they do have a following.
I do, yes. I watched some of the YouTube videos. Sadly, it's unfortunate that happens. I did meet Michael Murphy in when we were in Brussels.
There's a shortage of people not getting along in this world. This is part of the problem.
What do you have to say, by the way, about?
Well, he gives me a bit of a problem, because he interviewed Richard Gage. I think it was into January or February. I've got the date on my website. And he was talking to Richard Gage about 9/11. Now, I know that Richard Gage is a liar. I know that he's a liar, and I'm confident in saying that.
You're talking to Dane.
Dane is talking to Richard Gage. Now, I know that Richard Gage is a liar because, as I already said, I've got this clip of him, and he's been asked in public about this. He claims that Dr. Judy Wood doesn't address the bombs in the building, doesn't address thermite and all of this. Yet, I know for a fact that he has a copy of her book, because I have a copy of the check that he used to pay for to buy the book, because that was sent to me by a chap called Matthew Naus, who was with Richard Gage when he bought the book off him. And the check is, there's a copy of the check on my website, so I have the proof, right? And there's a picture of the contents page on my website. So if Richard Gage, as the head of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth has not read the only forensic investigation into the events of the World Trade Center, which is written by a specialist in materials engineering science, that person being Dr. Judy Wood, then that is a pretty...
She's no dummy. She's very credible.
That is a big problem, right? So I have that evidence there for people to look at if they wish. And then Dane was talking to Richard Gage, let's see, it was last year, I think. Yeah, it was late last year. And he said in this interview, the whole 9/11 issue, bottom to top, I'm reading this because I wrote this down, I typed this out, the audio clips on my website. There is really nothing that supports the official story and everything that supports the conclusion that your group, referring to Richard Gage's group, and again, how could you have a stronger group than that, 2,200 people? I know there's a lot of disinformation. We talked about this off the air. A lot of people that want to grab at straws, and they grab at, you know, I've seen mentioned laser beams from space and all this stuff. It's been designed to make people reject the actual facts. And he mentions something else after that, which I haven't written down. And then Richard Gage says, regarding Judy Wood, he drops Dr. Judy Wood's title, and her theory of directed energy weapons, which is not a theory, it's a set of evidence if you read it. What she does is look at the site around the towers and tries to find unusual evidence to try and support an unusual theory. She doesn't even know what evidence would support that theory because we don't know anything about directed energy weapons or how they work. So I'll just stop there because that's not true. The airborne laser system was developed by Boeing and Lockheed Martin, and the mobile tactical high energy laser system that was developed by Northrop Grumman. They're examples of directed energy weapons which have essentially gone into service.
You can buy them online. They sell them.
Pick an example. So Richard, we don't. And then Richard Gage continues. Yes. We don't even know if they exist. And there you go. That's another lie. We know there are experimental programs, but in the process that Judy Wood does is deny scientific forensic evidence that we do have for nanothermite. She also denies the evidence for explosives. There's a few other things that I haven't written down there. That is also not true. She doesn't deny the evidence. What she does is she explains that it's not that. Right? It's not what they say it is, and she proves why. She's a specialist in materials engineering science. Richard Gage is an architect. He doesn't have a PhD. He doesn't have the experience in materials engineering science. Then after that, Dane Wiggins says, we have one person, Dr. Judy Wood, ignoring evidence and disputing literally not just 2,200 experts, but many more when you count all these other first responders that heard the explosions. Well, that again is another lie because the first responders' talk of explosions is talked about in Dr. Judy Wood's book, if you actually read it. And I mentioned about the air tanks exploding. One person denying who knows how many, 2,500, 3,000 experts from various fields. Which would people be reasonable in believing? Obviously, you guys are standing on solid ground, nobody else is. And I will say again, Dr. G. Wood put her evidence into a court case in 2007. That was submitted by attorney Jerry Leapart to the court of the Southern District of New York. And that consisted of all the evidence to do with the evidence of energy effects on the materials at the World Trade Center, all that stuff. Richard Gage did not submit any of his evidence to legal scrutiny. Neither did that group, any of that group, or Stephen E. Jones. So basically what you've got there, whether Dane Wigginton is aware of it or not, I don't know, he's either believing Gage's lies or he's lying himself. And he says, we have one person, Dr. Judy Wood, ignoring evidence. Well, you know, he should count me in, because I was submitting evidence to that court case as well. I submitted an affidavit. So did John Hutchison. So did two or three other people that we know. So we're ignoring the evidence as well, so Dane is also wrong on that. I'm being pedantic, but there are many people now who know that Dr. Judy Wood is right, and it's not a theory. That's actually what happened, right? We can end the debate about what happened, at least as far as the World Trade Center goes. You know, once you study that book, once you study that evidence properly, spend the time, it might take you a month, it might take you 2 months to go through it.
So why don't we get the book out there, Andrew, just so people can...
Sorry?
Judy's
yeah, if you want to get the book, it's wheredidthetowersgo.com for the book site. It's available on Amazon. Please read the reviews on Amazon. I think it's got about 155 five-star reviews on Amazon. That one of the pages of comments of reviews has, one of the reviews has a 5,000 comments on it, right? One of the reviews for Dr. Judy Wood's book has 5,000 comments on it. How about that? That comment thread has been running for several years. So, yeah. So that book is described in the introduction as the most important book of the 21st century. That's been described that way by Dr. Eric Larson, of formerly of CUNY, I think he was at. I can't remember. It's New York University that he was at. My book is called 9/11 Finding the Truth. My book is free. In electronic formats. I do mention a little bit about Hurricane Erin stuff and things like that. You can watch Dr. Judy Wood's videos. You don't have to buy the book. It is going to cost you like $40, including shipping. It weighs £3. It's a hardback book, 500 pages, colour throughout. Just forensic evidence. You know, there's nothing about Al-Qaeda or, you know, or Zionism or anything. So if you're into that sort of stuff, maybe it's not the book for you. If you just want the basic facts, what happened to the World Trade Center, how it was cleaned up, you know, all that kind of thing, that's all in there.
Yeah, no, I found her movie today, or one of her movies, on YouTube, so it's very easy to find.
Yeah, and I mean, it's been quite a problem, because, for example, when Dr. Judy Wood came to the UK, there was nobody in London that wanted to organise a talk for her. I don't live in London. And what actually happened was people that wrote to me and said, can Dr. Judy Wood come and talk to our group? I said, yep, no problem. And we went, that was in 2012, and we went and talked to about 7 or 8 groups, no, maybe 9 or 10 groups across the UK and 1 or 2 in Scotland as well. So those people actually asked us, you know, to go and do a talk. We did. As simple as that. But we didn't have this huge machinery that architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth have, where they put on 30-day tours of Canada or Europe. You know, we can't do that. We don't have that sort of money. I mean, when you're doing something like that, you're going to be needing maybe, oh, at least $500 per venue, you know, to get everything set up and advertised. So for a 30-day tour, you're going to be needing $15,000. You know, we don't have that sort of money to do that.
Is Judy Wood easy to get on the radio?
She may. If you wanted to do an interview with her, she would probably be willing. What she'd like people to do is read her book first and ask her questions about the book, because she's very much focused on that. She did.
Well, you can tell her that I did my research on you, and that I did, you know, I did ask. I thought I asked.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, no,
I understand.
I think if you know if.
Yeah, I take my time. I do
yeah,
my research.
Yeah, but if you can, even better if you can read her book, because what's happened is. You know, it's like.
I'll definitely.
Sorry to interrupt, but a lot of what's in the book has been misquoted. For example, Dame Wigginton talks about space lasers. Now, that's what's become associated with Judy Wood's name, but she's never said that. She's never said that. That is what Stephen E. Jones characterized her research as. I know the history of that remark and where it comes from, but she's never actually said that. The reason, you know, I won't go into the reason why that is, because it's on her website anyway, if you went to look for it. But
Sure. Let's talk about you, because you're my guest, and I want people to find out where they can get a hold of you and listen to some of your talks. Now, I'm very impressed that you do give public presentations on a fairly regular basis. Can you let people know when you're going to be speaking in the near future?
Yes, thank you. Yeah,
because we do have listeners over there.
Oh, great!
In the UK.
Well, yeah, that I'll be doing 3 talks coming up. I've got one on the 26th of May, which in the evening, 7:30 in Shrewsbury, which is not too far from Birmingham in the central of the UK. And then the next one will be on June the 15th. In a place called Lytham St Anne's, which is New Horizons, that's in the northwest of England. And then I'll be doing another one on the 17th, 2 days later, in Hull, which is on the east coast. The subjects there will be, the one on the 26th is going to be called Removing Truth's Protective Layers. In the first hour I'll talk about the Apollo hoax, and in the second hour I'll talk about 9/11. The other one I'll be talking about is secrets in the solar system, NASA stuff, and then the final one is a secret space program.
Okay, awesome. Well, I better say thanks to you, Andrew. It's been an incredible discussion, and I'm very impressed with your rigor and level of analysis. So thanks a lot for coming on, and hopefully...
Much appreciated. Thank you all, everyone.
Thanks a lot, Angela.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian. It's checktheevidence.com if you guys want to find out more information, and we'll see you soon. It's been I Am Major with Brian Porter.